Welcome back everyone to the channel. Tonight's video, I am bringing you four allegedly true swamp stories. You decide. Now sit back, relax, dim the lights, and let's get spooky. It was late night in the summer of 2022 when I packed up my gear in the early evening to go on a monthly fishing trip with one of my buddies, Jesse. He was a shorter, skinny fellow with a mustache and buzz cut who served with me in the Marine Corps a couple years back. After our contracts were over, we both moved to the same state and kept in touch. And through our shared hobby of late-night fishing, going on trips into the Louisiana Bayou became a monthly occasion. As the sun was just about to set, I threw my rods and tackle into the back of my pickup truck, driving an hour or two to get to the marina where Jesse's old bass boat was, waiting to go. I arrived and hopped out of my truck and saw Jesse drinking a bottle of beer, checking his engine as we prepared the set off to bring in a haul of fat catfish. In no time, we were anchored in the middle of a deep pool in the bayou, just as the sun fully set and disappeared over the horizon. There was mangrove trees, lily pads, and weeds surrounding the edges of the water, while the glowing eyes of spiders and insects reflected off our lights. We shared stories about our previous fishing trip and experiences in the military, drank and laughed as slowly, the giant channel catfish began to nibble and tug at our cat bait and circle hooks. Just as the fish started biting, I realized I'd left my phone behind, and I sighed knowing I couldn't take any pictures of our catch. "This bastard's huge," Jesse said, grinning and holding his cigar between his teeth as he held up a 15-pound channel catfish at the end of his line. "Good eating, too," I replied. "Toss it in the cooler and I'll put another one on your line." Jesse chuckled and admired his catch before he put it in our cooler, knowing that in a few hours, it would be a pile of delicious deep-fried Cajun fillets with pounds of crawdads that he had caught earlier. I put a dead minnow on my line and casted my line out, standing in silence for a while before I noticed something. It was only midnight, and while only a few seconds earlier our surroundings had been filled with the sounds of frogs, birds, and insects, it had gone completely silent.
"Ain't that weird?" Jesse said, sitting on an overturned bucket and slowly reeling in his line.
"Yeah," I asked. "You noticed it too?"
"Damn right I did. There's no noise, no crickets, nothing. Usually this time of night it sounds like a jungle, but it's gone quiet."
"Spoke my mind," I replied, my hands slightly sweating.
"Don't worry about it."
"The fish are all gone too," Jesse sighed.
"What's up with this place?"
I looked out into the dark, wet swamp beyond, and I noticed two reflecting eyes in the darkness coming to life as a very large gator coming up from behind us, but quickly turning the other direction and swimming away.
"So, how's the family?"
Jesse asked, snapping me out of my trance.
"Oh, they're fine. The boys are finally getting into football, and it's their first year in grade 8. "Grade 8 already? Last time I remember, they could barely walk," Jesse chuckled. "It's like they say, they grow up so fast." "Shoot, I mean it feels like we were off base getting crap-faced in San Diego like yesterday. Man, we're getting old as hell."
I heard some splashing around 100 feet in front of us, and whatever it was, it sounded big. I set up my fishing rod against the edge of the boat and stood up, pointing the spotlight in the direction I heard the noise coming from, but it was just out of reach.
"Don't bother," Jesse said. "It's probably a gator doing another death roll."
Weird, because I heard the wildlife only goes silent when there's an apex predator nearby, I suggested.
It's nothing, probably. Just enjoy the fishing.
We should change spots.
Enjoy the fishing, Jesse replied, spitting into the water with an aggression I hadn't seen in years.
All right, I said, holding my hands up with a defensive grin. I knew something was off. I had seen Jesse get pissed as hell and have outbursts before, and I sometimes caught him staring blankly for hours. This was usually because of his occasional PTSD, but right now his mood shift was something I hadn't seen before. We both fished quietly for a few more minutes before I felt my hook sink into something heavy, and I reeled, only to feel a dead weight at the end of the line. Sighing and thinking it had gotten snagged in a piece of wood or some weeds, I begrudgingly reeled it in when the object breached the surface. Around a few feet in front of the boat, hooked at the end of my line was a smaller but very disfigured-looking catfish. This channel catfish had giant pale spots of skin across its body, and it had several more eyes than it should have, with more human-looking teeth and spines on the underside of its belly.
What the hell?
I said, pulling out my folding knife and cutting the line right off, not wanting to haul in that abomination. Listen, Jesse, I think we should really change spots. The fish are screwed. I heard splashing in the distance.
No, he replied, not making eye contact. We don't ever leave.
Hey man, how about we call it a night? I said, patting him on the back. I'm tired and...
The gods must feast.
What the hell? Jesse, is this one of your... Jesse finally turned to look back at me, and my heart sank. This wasn't Jesse. His eyes were pure black, with the light reflecting off them to give an animalistic look, and his face was the most expressionless I had ever seen it been. I could only describe his gaze and eyes as pure evil.
They need sacrifices, Tyler.
I glanced a further bit beyond Jesse and into the darkness of the bayou, where I could make out hundreds of glowing white eyes staring back at me, from the water, from the treetops, everywhere. Jesse slowly walked towards me, his stare and evil frickin' eyes slowly sinking my heart as I rested my hand on the handle of my pistol holstered at my side. Don't come any frickin' closer, I replied. You're not, I swear all. When he came within a few feet, I fired, grazing his side before I fired several more shots into his chest and face, as he stumbled, before falling into the water behind him and sinking. My heart beat like hell and my vision was blurring as I ran over to the anchor, pulling it up as fast as I could before I started the boat and drove as fast as it would go in the direction we came from. I took one last glance behind me, and what I saw will haunt me for the rest of my days I walk this earth. I saw Jesse, with his back turned to me, floating a few feet above the water's surface, shirtless and blood trickling from his wounds. Above him was a dead 20-foot-long alligator with its stomach sliced open and blood pouring out, its head hanging from a rope tied to a tree above it. Surrounding them were at least 100 of those eyes, all staring before they slipped back into the deep water and darkness of the bayou as I escaped. As soon as I made it back to the docks, I didn't bother tying the boat to the docks or take my gear. I just got off onto dry land, got in my truck, and I drove like hell down the road. Back at my house, I was alone. My wife must have taken the kids out to somewhere, and I was by myself when I rushed to find my phone. As soon as I turned it on, I realized I had at least a dozen missed calls from Jesse. I held my pistol in one hand and my cell phone in the other as I sweated as I called him back, waiting in horror and anticipation.
Hey, Tyler?
His normal-sounding voice gave me a slight sense of relief.
"It's me," I replied, trying to sound calm. "What's with the missed calls?"
"What's with you?"
Jesse asked, chuckling. "I called you like 1,000 times. I had to cancel today's trip because I fell down the stairs, broke my leg, and wanted to tell you. But guess who didn't frickin' pick up?"
"Your leg's broken? So you didn't go outside today?"
"I mean, besides the emergency room, no. I stayed inside and watched one of those nature channels."
"You weren't out on your bass boat?" I asked, the fear creeping back as I looked around my dark house.
"Jesus, man, did you not hear what I just said? If I went out today, I'd collapse before I could get a monster at the end of my line. Why'd you ask?"
"Nothing. Never mind."
I hung up, just to look out the window into the darkness and see the mimic of Jesse, grinning with his bloody face pressed up against my window as his dead eyes stared into me. In his hand, he was holding a cell phone with my caller ID on the screen.
I believe there is something beyond this life. Something we as human beings are only capable of imagining when our minds cease to function. That's a statement that many can see the contradiction in. How we can imagine if our minds can cease to function. That question, along with my belief, just sounds right. It's like a fact you know to be true, even though you don't have any proof. I think of the stories of people being dead and coming back. Many stories often contradict each other. Some say they saw nothing, that they didn't even notice they died. You would call this oblivion. Others say they saw heaven or hell, or heard a voice they took to be God. Yet the only problem I have with these stories is that they are only a portion of the truth. Our minds are limited, so what these people hear and see, if their stories are true, is severely edited by the limited comprehension of their minds, which brought me back to square one for a long time, at least until the 18th of March, 1989. I was a substitute professor, often taking the place of other professors in mathematics, theology, and biology. When I wasn't substituting for professors at the university, I was spending my time in my office, studying my weakest specialization, biology. Believe me when I say that most of the information in biology today still comes from before the 1960s. Anyways, I received a call, derailing my train of thought. I had forgotten to take the phone off the hook, so I was annoyed when I picked it up.
"What is it?" I growled.
"Professor Lee, it's Harold. I'm calling about the theory you put forward to Professor Jameson," a young man spoke on the phone. It took me a while to recall the name. When I did, my anger slipped away, dissolving like cotton candy in water. Professor Jameson was a neurologist, and his knowledge certainly outpaced mine on the subject. Still, that kind of knowledge can be limited in some fields, as you could already assume the answer. It is only from ignorant imagination can you think up new and interesting ways to explore a field.
"Yes? What did he have to say?" I told him. "It's been almost a year, so it better be good."
"That's just the thing, Professor," Harold said nervously. "He would like to discuss your theory in person."
"I'm not driving down, nor flying to San Francisco. Put him on the phone."
"Professor, we're in Louisiana. We could meet you at the university in 10 minutes if need be, but Professor Jameson recommends that you go home first and change. He has something to show you in the swamps."
"I tell him to meet me at this address in 30 minutes, I said, immediately putting my briefcase on the desk to pack some essentials.
After leaving LSU, I went straight home as instructed and changed. Jameson and Harold were already waiting inside the car by the time I finished.
I took my briefcase of notes and marched out the front door. The humidity in Baton Rouge that day wasn't the worst, but in all the excitement, I was already sweating. I climbed into the back of the car, and Jameson gave Harold the signal to drive. Harold was a student, no doubt an intern assistant for Professor Jameson. He had all the signature signs of youth, along with well-kept ginger hair and freckles on his face. The picture of eager innocence only made Jameson seem more fearsome in contrast. Jameson was a few years older than me, but he looked almost a decade older. With a gray beard, bushy eyebrows, and a stern expression, I couldn't help but feel like I was the student in his presence. It didn't help that he was a tall, brawny man, which only made his booming words that much more intimidating. "You are not what I expected, Professor Lee," Jameson said. I wondered if it had something to do with my ethnicity that threw him off, but I know now it was the way I carried myself. My clothes were colorful, my hair long, and no doubt I looked as excited as I felt. "Yet your letter shows remarkable intelligence, so that's enough for me. Many times over the past few months, I wanted to throw it away and save myself the pain it would put me through." "Excuse me? I'm sorry." "Don't be. This is the most fun I've had in this field for a long time." "Oh, wait. Does that mean..." "No, I have not tested your theory. There's something you and I are going to do right now. I set up the experiment in the swamps because I found that the bog here in Baton Rouge, especially near the Mississippi, contains the right pH to conduct it." The excitement had taken over and forced me into silence. Jameson and I ended up discussing the meaning behind the possible results. But I noticed that he didn't care much for the theological implications of the experiment was successful. Instead, he was far more interested in the biological implications. I believed he was one of the many academics who believed that the next step in human evolution would be an artificial one. How that would come about is widely discussed today, from the biologists to the engineers to the bioengineers. Professor Jameson fell silent when we entered the swamps. It was almost dusk, the warm orange of the sky complementing the cooling greens of the trees. While the temperature dropped, the humidity was growing more intense, and I could understand why. We weren't so close to the Mississippi that a cool current of air helped ease the heat. Harold pulled the car over to the side of the road. I climbed out after the two and followed them down the trail. Harold eventually pulled out a flashlight and led us between trees and pools of festering water. The sounds of insects and frogs were almost deafening. "What exactly is this experiment?" I asked. "Surely a lab would be a better place for this." "I would, but those experiments were failures before they even began," Jameson muttered. "Your theory that a typical human mind cannot conceive of what happens after death simply because we don't have enough gray matter nor the ability to take advantage of it is a fascinating one. It requires precise results, large tanks, and other things. While I can certainly create such an experiment in a lab, I simply don't have the funding or space. It would be better to conduct it in an open environment to at least get a promising result." "Do you intend to submerge the mines in the swamp?" I asked. "A small portion of the swamp, one that is maintained not only by the lively environment, but also by our equipment." I heard the generator before I saw it. There beside a pool of swamp water was a research station built on a platform. I didn't want to say it was a professional platform either. No more than a few wooden poles and planks. What was perched on top of it were a few machines protected by a blue tarp. Harold led us up the stairs and started lighting the lanterns and electric bug zappers. A lot of bug zappers. "A lot of bugs like the lights, so we use these to take care of them," Harold explained. "My brother owns a store full of them in San Francisco." "Enough. Start getting everything in order," Jameson said, Lee, follow me to the subjects.
Subjects? I said, Jameson stopping at the end of the platform overlooking the pool.
More than one?
Jameson reached and grabbed a switch hanging from a wire. Two large lights beside us activated when he flicked the switch, lighting up the pool in front of us. There, even through the murky green waters and pond scum, I could see several pale forms in the water.
Seven subjects, each with a different amount of gray matter, Jameson explained. I cannot simply connect several minds, otherwise there would be a conflict for control. Luckily, I am the Professor John Jameson. As I am sure you are aware, I have found a way to artificially grow brain matter, but it didn't have any use before. Unless it grew with a living organism, it was just a bunch of complex cells. A pointless breakthrough that finally has a purpose. Jameson pointed to the leftmost figure. Starting from there, that one has a fully intact mind, Jameson said. Nothing has been changed for him, but as you could see, their heads are larger with each iteration. That one has twice as much brain matter. Then that one has three times as much, and so on. If a noisy reporter were around, they would have the story of a lifetime. Even if their bodies were donated to science, the ethics committee would go ballistic to see what they were used for. While the water was murky, I could see that the rightmost subject, the one with seven times the brain matter, was braced to hold the incredible mass that was in its head. His cranium was wrapped in specialized plastic. It was an abomination. They are preserved, but given enough time, even this treated water will damage their bodies, Jameson explained. That's why the experiment will be conducted now. Harold, is everything in place? I looked over at the intern. I could tell he was becoming less and less eager during the drive to the swamps. Once he was standing there, setting everything in place, eyes wide with fear, but mouth closed and body still.
Yes, sir, Harold said. Everything is connected, ready whenever.
Harold turned to a small screen and studied it, but I could see him glancing at the water now and then. Well, Lee, shall we find out what lies beyond this mortal plane? Jameson said. He wasn't asking for my permission. He just wanted to know if I was ready. I certainly didn't know if I could stop him if I felt so inclined to prevent such an experiment. Instead, I said this with shame. I was excited. I recognized that it was wrong, but I didn't care. It was a dark fantasy come true for me. An unspoken intellectual fetish, a taste of madness. I think I even smiled when I nodded. Jameson approached a set of wires near an array of old batteries and what looked like several coils of copper wire with a glass tube. I noticed he was looking at the water when he reached for what looked like a handle with red tape around it. When he turned it, there was a snapping noise that periodically clicked every few seconds. It was a sound that should have been more smothered by the sounds of life all around us, but as we stared at the water, the sounds of nature seemed to grow softer. The sun had fallen beyond the horizon, and the sky was a dark blue, becoming black. Looking back, there were so many signs that what we had done was wrong. A crime against nature, and perhaps against something greater. A board of lights near Harold had lit up. He studied the bulbs and then pointed to the topmost line of sights.
The subjects are alive, Harold said. Wait.
The green light labeled S1 turned off, as did S2, S3, and S4. First four subjects are deceased, Harold said.
To be expected, Jameson said quickly when he looked at him. Even with all the electricity and chemicals in the world, we couldn't keep such a body stable and alive for long. I imagine that removing the physical hindrance they had over their brain is what made them last as long in the first place.
What do you mean? I asked.
Well, the illusion of life is...
Jameson fell silent and turned back to the water. We looked at it as well. The subjects remaining suspended in the water, but according to whatever machine they were hooked up to, subjects 5, 6, and 7 were alive. Clearly in an unconscious state, but their hearts were beating as long as the current was running through them. But they should be, Jameson murmured. What's wrong? I asked. Their advanced minds have stabilized the current, used it to maintain their life, but why are they still unconscious? Jameson said. Jameson clapped his hands together but received no reaction. He yelled at them, but still nothing. He then turned to Harold. Destabilize the current with a high-intensity pulse should shock them awake, Jameson said. If they have been deceased for some time, perhaps it takes time for them to fully awaken, I suggested. They might be comatose. Half-dead is still dead, Jameson said. Do it, Harold.
Yes, sir,
Harold stuttered, his fear and disgust showing. When I looked back at the lake, I saw the bodies twitch, even the first four subjects. The high-intensity pulse was an unresisted current that made the water steam in a second, yet the bodies remained. That's the one other reason they need to remain submerged, Jameson said. We watched the bodies. My eyes were fixed on the seventh. It would sound unusual when I say this, but even though he was as still as a statue, he seemed alive. Maybe it was the slightest movements that I didn't notice that made him seem that way, but I just felt like he was awake. Yet nothing happened. I then became concerned by the idea that the masks connected to their faces weren't supplying them oxygen, that maybe they were drowning. Then I turned to Professor Jameson. He was staring straight at me. Professor, do you think... I began. Jameson's head cocked to the side, and from behind him, I could see a dark figure. The stern professor fell to the side and into the water. Harold stood there, eyes closed, mouth hanging open, and in his hand was a bloodied screwdriver.
What have...
I stuttered to reply. But without realizing it, I backed into one of the machines and found myself cornered.
What have you done, Harold? Why did...
I was mentally screaming at my body to ready myself for a fight, but in my panic, there was this high-pitched tone that seemed to pierce my brain, like a screaming beetle had crawled inside my head. Even in that high-pitched tone, I could hear it. A voice. A voice that I could barely hear, let alone understand. Harold lunged for me as the buzzing faded. It was sheer luck that my hand found something to swing at him. A small fire extinguisher. It knocked his hand aside, but it was my kick that sent him into the water with the subjects and the deceased professor. When I looked down at them all, I saw the last three subjects, 5, 6, and 7, staring at me with their fully milky white eyes. The buzzing returned with greater intensity, and it took all I had to push it aside. I looked away from the subjects and trudged away, as if in pain. The further away I got from the water, the easier it became to think. I grabbed a flashlight off the table, probably the same that Harold had used to guide us to the experiment. I would use it to help me find my way out. Soon enough, all I could hear was the sound of a large generator rumbling away. I knew that I had to do something, and at that moment, I thought turning it off would work. All it did was deactivate the lights and silence the rumbling. The quiet of the night became a lot more startling, making it easy to hear the sound of water splashing as something climbed out of the swamp. Looking back, I saw something just beyond the beam of the flashlight. A figure I couldn't recognize without getting closer, yet my ears told me it was more than one. This is not a story of my bravery. I heard that sound and thought I was being pursued, so I ran. I turned my back and fled into the swamp. Even with the flashlight, I sometimes dropped knee-deep into bog water or stumbled over a rock.
yet cowardice is a powerful force. And yes, I was a coward. Even now, I regret fleeing as I did. After 10 minutes of mud and slapping away insects that felt larger than they were, I made it to my car, not that I could use it. Without the keys, I couldn't drive, but I could follow the road back into Baton Rouge. Even though it took far longer to reach civilization by foot than it did to leave the swamps, I felt much safer. No amount of darkness or mundane nightmares could prepare for what I had felt when I saw the terrifying results of that experiment take their toll. It's been over 30 years, and I still find a distant, high-pitched tone blaring in the back of my mind. A reminder whenever I am close to forgetting, or a deterrent whenever I try to decipher it all. Even with all that I have learned, I cannot understand what happened. I didn't report the incident, not for reasons like protecting those who would dare go there, or for the fear of being thrown in the prison as if I had anything to do with what had happened. I was afraid that the experiment would jeopardize my reputation and destroy my career. That's what I cared about at the time. The bodies of those involved were never found, at least not to my knowledge. My question of what lies beyond has been half answered, but like most answers in theology, it was an answer that raised more questions. I didn't write this for my peace after all these years, or to excuse my involvement. I know that I will be punished, one way or another, in this life or the next. I write this to confirm a fear that we've all had since we were children. Although the dead may look that way, they're not asleep. It was in the 1990s when people residing near the swamplands of Louisiana have claimed to have seen the mysterious creature called the Swamp Bodies. The Swamp Bodies are creatures that were allegedly dwelling in the swamps, stalking the swamps during the night while leaving deep footprints in the mud puddles and soil. In July 2005, an alligator hunter along with his four friends disappeared while hunting around 5 in the afternoon. One survivor of the incident luckily returned after being lost in the swamp for 3 days and then was temporarily held by the local sheriff for questioning. The survivor stated that he had seen the swamp bodies with his own very eyes, and he described that the swamp bodies were large golem-like creatures. They had thick layers of dark green Spanish moss covering their actual bodies, which is probably made of mud, soil, and stone. According to the survivor, the swamp bodies have no eyes but could sense a human within 25 feet. And if it senses one, it will stomp its feet towards the victim with a quake and a little thud from the ground, possibly a signal that the victim must flee to safety or stay out of its presence. The survivor also mentioned that the swamp bodies have the foul stench of a decomposing corpse, blended with the natural odor of the swamp water. Recently, in March 2013, the bones of the alligator hunter were found. Interestingly, the bones were found to have a few layers of soil and rock and some small amounts of moss covering them. Unfortunately, for those other three, they are still out there in the marsh, waiting to be discovered. However, whatever the thing that animates the swamp bodies, to the best of the scientists who are still studying the remains of the alligator hunter, is still unknown. It all started when my dad and I went canoeing on Douglas Lake, Michigan. I was proudly named after the lake. It was June, and we had grabbed our paddles, and Dad hopped in the rusting silver canoe. I brushed a piece of dirt from the steel hook on my paddle, used to be hung in the shed. I'm going to head out for a while to see if I could find that bald eagle's nest Adam was talking about, Aunt Kathy said as she gazed out into the Turtle Bay. as the late afternoon sun swept close to the tops of the gentle pines, willows, and oaks. Dad and I were going there for the same cause. I looked over at my siblings, Emily, Will, and Mike, as they chatted noisily with my second cousins, Adam, Louie, and Abby, around the roaring bonfire. Our other older cousins started to gather around. "Be back soon, Doug, otherwise Louie will eat up all the s'mores," Willie said jokingly, patting Louie's gut. Louie isn't that big. We just like to make jokes about him to screw with him due to the fact that he was an only child, and he doesn't seem to have too much fun hanging around adults all the time. I petted my dog Snoopy as he trotted towards the smell of food. "I'll be back soon, buddy, behave." I smiled as he rolled over onto his back. "If you even touch any food that doesn't land on the ground, I swear I'm going to come back here and kick your..." I trailed off. Snoopy almost seemed to smile and nod. I patted his head and kissed him on the nose. I looked back just as I hopped into the wobbly boat and suddenly felt a wave of sadness, like I would never see the scene again. I shook my head, brushing my black hair, scraping my forehead. I would see that all again. I was perfectly healthy, and death wasn't ready to take me yet. It couldn't have been a better day for canoeing. The lake was so calm, and the early summer sun warmed my wet skin as my dad and I splashed each other as we drifted out towards the bay. "We have to stay in the center of the river," Dad said, poking my soaked shirt with his paddle. I glanced at him confused, raising an eyebrow. "The slugs will get us from the ferns," Dad said, holding back a smile. I rolled my eyes. "If you're wondering what I'm even talking about, there are at least three types of monsters said to haunt the swampy river within Turtle Bay. I'll explain them briefly. 1. Slugs. A race of cannibalistic slugs were made to get rid of slug infestation at the lake. But the slugs mutated and only three remain, and they prey on humans and other large animals. 2. Swamp Boy. A teenage boy whose name faded into history, who went into the river to seek refuge in the middle of a storm when a tree fell and sunk his boat, drowning him in the leech-infested water. 3. Dareens. A murderous race of Indians who could turn into deer at the will to escape the white man. We began to approach the bay, arguing whether or not the monsters existed. I opened my mouth to say that the slugs likely were killed of old age when my dad clapped his big hand over my mouth. "Look at the deer," Dad whispered, pointing with his big finger. I followed his gaze to see a gentle red doe lap in the water, its cloven hoofs prancing delicately on the water, easily keeping its feet from sinking into the quicksand-like mud. I smiled as she snapped her head at my dad as he let out a sudden sneeze. I expected her to dart off, escape into the marsh, and never be seen again. Wrong. She just stood there, staring at us menacingly. She began to act rabid, shaking her head and stomping her feet and yelping into the thick woods. Dad and I looked at each other nervously. "Deer don't act like that," I mouthed to Dad, me being the zoologist in the family. Dad nodded. The deer were still now, making no movement except for an occasional ear flick. We came within 20 feet before she frolicked off. My mind raced as I thought of what the cause of that strange behavior could be. I was worried about the thought of rabies, but I tried to keep my mind off of it. We rounded the first turn, about 15 feet into the river, when the current suddenly moved against us, slowing us down so much we couldn't move at all. We paddled harder, my hands going numb with how tightly I gripped the paddle. Though the birds above screeched loudly, I could still hear the faint sounds in the forest. As I listened closely, a faint whisper came from the tall grass to my right. Like a T-Rex from Jurassic Park, my head snapped to the right. The creature was still, but still a slight rustling emitted. My head was lowered, my ear pointed to the soft rustling, like Wolverine from X-Men. I noticed a black mass in the water, shifting slowly. It was probably humus, that powdery black residue from decomposition. But it inched closer. Now I focused on the mass. It moved slowly, like stalking its prey. I felt the uncontrollable urge of adrenaline and hit it with my paddle. It swam off quickly. I watched it retreat down the river.
"Some help would be nice," Dad said. I suddenly forgot about the creatures.
As I began the paddle, I struggled to remember what I was thinking about. It took me 5 seconds to remember. A low-pitched sound, like stiff rubber was being stretched, suddenly came from the same place the whisper was from. I did the same thing. My head snapped to the right. There was a faint pluck, and something snapped on the shore nearby, across the river. The beast darted off, making little noise as it ran. I strained to look over my shoulder to see a dark red feather, no, three, lie in the nearby shore of the river, like an arrow. Now, I could be slow to figure things out at times, but I was able to put two and two together to figure out someone or something had shot an arrow at Dad and me. That sent ice cubes down my spine. I quickly pushed that aside and kept my mouth shut. The birds, like chickadees, blue jays, cardinals, seagulls, and ravens, all screeched loudly above our heads and swooped down close to our heads, both their songs and eerie cries echoing throughout the swamp, brightly lit with beautiful rays of sunlight that poked through the immensely tall trees, which swarmed with vampiric mosquitoes. It was mostly fine, except for the homicidal birds and the occasional unrelenting current.
"The birds are monsters, look out!"
Dad said as he swatted at a mosquito on his paddle, me dodging a chickadee that dove uncomfortably close to my left ear. I couldn't help but roll my eyes when I thought about how ridiculously Dad was acting, though I was still shaken by the creature and the arrow. We stopped where Swamp Boy supposedly drowned by the fallen tree. I poked the rotting boards with my paddle, swarming with leeches, diving beetles, minnows, and other small water-dwelling creatures. I looked closely at the planks. I heard footsteps in the reeds. I looked up. My mind raced through animals. I thought birds, bears, even Bigfoot. Eventually, my mind settled on a hiker or a hunter. I barely caught a glimpse of blonde hair. "What do you think the others are doing?" I yawned. Dad shrugged. I opened my mouth to say Louie was probably eating everything when Dad stopped me. He pointed up. I shrugged, shaking my head, honestly confused.
"The birds," Dad said. "They've stopped."
I gave Dad a sarcastic look. Heck yeah, I heard the birds had stopped, but that just meant that a predator had entered the area. I thought it was probably just a coyote, fox, puma, even a bear. But then I realized something. The bow and arrow. The black mass in the water. The figure in the reeds. The birds stopped screeching and diving us. The insects around us mysteriously disappeared. I glanced into the water. All the animals swam towards the lake in a leaping, black, squirming blob in the river. I looked at Dad, my eyes widening and narrowing. A faint rustling burst from my left, then right, then forwards, backwards, then all around us. I felt like a gazelle being stalked by a pride of hungry lions. A soft wind pushed the grass and the rustling was lost in the breeze. Dad turned pale. I saw the fear in Dad's eyes and him fighting the urge to puke and realized it was all real. "We have to get out of here," we said in unison. Dad started to row. I tried to lift my oar, but something prevented me from pushing us away from the hellish place. "You remember what used to be hung in the shed? Well, that was caught on the boards." "My oar is stuck," I screamed. A murmur slipped from the air around us. I felt a wave of panic as voices and deer-like grunts bursted from the grass. Some of them spoke English, others in a language I couldn't understand. As the voices started, the forest came to life, all its attention focused violently on Dad and me.
I'll get the big one, one grunted. The smaller one saw us. Kill him first, replied another. Which one should I kill? The white skins will not see their tribes after this. The small one seems to have some trouble. He will be mostly easy. The big one looks sick. Let him suffer.
I heard the last one and totally lost it. The paddle didn't seem too important, and I let out a lion-like yell that I didn't even find remotely human. It echoed menacingly, and the forest fell silent. Even the wind seemed to stop at its presence. The voices shut up immediately. With the burst of adrenaline, I ripped the oar away and hurled a piece of wood that was stuck to the hook at the grass. The adrenaline subsided, and Dad and I began the paddle as fast and hard as we ever could. Though it wasn't that easy because the sudden loss of adrenaline felt how I imagined a hangover. The voices started again.
The small one hit me. Kill him!
A furious voice said. The voices whooped and the swamp came to life twice as violent as before. The fish and leeches reappeared and slammed against the canoe, normally not doing much, but with how many there were, the canoe began to rock and sway. In fact, how much the canoe swept in the current, we went into a sandbar and we were sitting ducks. Dad threw down his paddle, leaped out, and began the push.
Stay in the boat, Dad hollered.
But...
Stay in the damn boat, Dad said.
I nodded, disappointed but relieved. He pushed, but nothing happened. The voices laughed, and something slammed the canoe and felt a slight pain in my leg. Glancing in the water, I saw another huge black mass. I swung my paddle. The creature retreated once again. Dad continued the push, relying on brute strength. My mind raced for answers. I murmured to myself under my breath. Caught on a branch? No. Just ferns. Rocks? No, I didn't see any. Wind? No wind. The fish are holding us back. What? No, damn it. Maybe something in the sand? No, wait.
Son of a bitch!
The solution hit me like a frickin' brick. We were stuck on a suction in the wet sand beneath the canoe, like what happens to beached whales all the time. I set my paddle in the canoe and began to dig in the sand. Water began to flow beneath us and the canoe suddenly jolted forward. Dad hopped in and began the paddle. The voices intensified. I waited for Dad to look away. Go F yourselves, you little pricks. I mouthed many swear words to the reeds. I won't hesitate to kick your asses. Go to hell. My threats got more and more gruesome. Like I said, I loved and I hated that feeling with everything I knew. The figure with blonde hair appeared again, moving at the most unbelievable speed. I bared my teeth and growled.
Douglas, start paddling, damn it! Dad howled.
Dad and I paddled and paddled until our arms were stuck like that and did nothing but propel us forward. Eventually, after what felt like an eternity, a figure came into the distance. I held my paddle like a sword. I couldn't see him from the extreme distance that well, but I could make out a handsomely carved paddleboard and a long, elegant paddle. I distinctively saw a feminine figure.
Aunt Kathy?
I screamed, relieved. My dad's cousin's presence seemed to drive away the figures, their grunts and howls echoing through the woods. I snarled, fear and hatred chumming within my body. The pain came back, and I realized the creature had cut my leg, but I didn't care. It was only a nick at the skin.
Hey, Doug, Donald.
Aunt Kathy smiled, but the smile faded away fast.
What happened to you? Looked like you'd just seen a ghost.
I just wanted to scream.
We were
being followed by a herd of deer, and Doug screamed like a little girl. Dad sputtered, cutting me off.
But,
I began. Dad shot me a look. Don't make me look bad, he mouthed. He made up lies. He said that there were only deer, foxes, and canaries. He denied everything I said. And you know what? Aunt Kathy actually bought it. I wanted to just whack Dad in the back of the head with this paddle.
but I didn't. Out of 7 billion people, I was stuck with this guy who had seen what I saw. Dad finished his little web of lies, and Aunt Kathy asked if the eagle nest was anywhere to be found. No, I said, but we saw something other than eagles. Dad shot me a look once more, and I stared at him with total frustration. As we paddled from the bay, a small voice in my head said, "Don't turn around," but an even louder voice drowning out that little one said, "Turn around, you frickin' jackass." Upon doing so, I saw another arrow hit the water and a deer disappear into the brush. Dad denied the entire thing until he was drunk by the fire and a buck acted strangely, similarly to the doe we had seen earlier that day. He told everyone everything. The next day, he tried to deny it, but everyone heard him, and almost the entire family was up that year. The only people that weren't there were Grandma and Grandpa, because Grandpa had died that day in the hospital from mustard gas from the Vietnam War. You could go ahead and say that I'm full of it. I'm just making it all up. Go ahead, say it. I know what I saw, and it's all true. All of it. I don't scare easily, but that scared the living crap out of me. While I'm not totally scarred for life, I have the occasional nightmares, hallucinations, and flashbacks. It's caused anxiety. Sometimes it's hard to sleep. You can ridicule me, tease me, and point fingers. But let me just say this. Stay out of the swamps.